Greetings once again to all of Turdville. Turd here with the latest installment, perhaps actually the last installment of 2014, of the much acclaimed, critically acclaimed Access to Access webinar series. Today we have a special guest that we've done a few podcasts with in the past, but we've not had him in yet for an A2A, and gosh, no time like the present. We have John Butler with us. John is a guy I met through, I guess, our mutual friend, if we want to call him that, John Ned.
Right.
Can you find him a proper barber, do you think? God,
it's funny. He's actually very well-dressed, but he can't seem to figure out what to do with his hair.
I think for Christmas I'm going to send him, like, some mousse or some, you know, real heavy. John has a very interesting background. He's an American by birth and was educated here in the U.S., but he moved after spending some time in New York with Bankers Trust. He moved across the pond, as you might say, to Germany, where he worked for Deutsche Bank. And then from there was recruited over to Lehman Brothers. And then after that, his career has morphed into a kind of a multitasker, if you will. He's managing partner of Amphora Capital out of London, helps advise one of their funds there, but he also does a lot of consulting work. He is he's got a very unique perspective of events, both here in the U.S. and in Europe and in Russia. And gosh, no better time like the present to have him in. So, John, thank you very much for spending some time in Turdville. It's very much appreciated.
Oh, that's my pleasure.
How did I do on the bio? Did I miss anything important there? I mean, like I said, you have such a unique perspective because you've worked in Europe, and so you've got a lot of European contacts, but you've got a lot of American contacts, and I would imagine that all kind of fed into the information you were able to supply in your great book that I didn't mention earlier called The Golden Revolution. Would you say that added to your perspective there?
Well, I think it definitely did. I mean, the only thing I would add to that is that at both Lehman Brothers and Deutsche Bank, I worked at a fairly senior role. I was a managing director at both institutions, running teams responsible for global macro strategy and systematic trading. And it's perhaps unusual that an American working in London would have had those sorts of jobs. And so perhaps it does give me a bit of a unique perspective. And the other thing I would say is that throughout my professional career, although I didn't use it as a day-to-day analysis tool, I did have a grounding and background in Austrian economics, for those who know what that is. Yep. From a very young age, I had a somewhat visionary, to be honest, teacher in high school in the U.S. who taught me economics and who insisted that we get ourselves exposed to Austrian economic thinking, not just the more dominant monetarist and Keynesian thinking that was very prominent back in the 1980s. Yep. And so I think that formed quite an impression on me and maybe helps to shape my perspective as well.
Yeah, how fortunate you were. Exactly. I mean, I majored in economics and all I got was guns and butter and all that Keynesian stuff. I can't imagine it. It certainly had to help kind of, I guess, frame your rationale, the way you look at things as you grew up and went to college and everything else. You wrote this fantastic book that I mentioned earlier. Came out, gosh, maybe, is it 2 years ago, John, The Golden Revolution?
It came out in the spring of 2012, so you're going on over 2 years now.
Wow. I bet it should still be on the Amazon hot list, if you ask me, though. It's a tremendous book, and I would encourage everybody, if you have not read it, you'll see the link here is on the podcast page to take you right to Amazon to buy it. It's a great book. You know, one of the things you wrote about – well, there are a number of great items in the book, but one of the things you wrote about that is I guess, relevant in today's – discussion is you chose one of the kind of war game, financial currency war game scenarios that Jim Rickards has written about and discussed with you and others. And that's the idea of eventually a gold-backed currency. And I think in your book, you actually said, what if one day Russia wakes up and backs the ruble with gold? What would happen? You know, it didn't happen today. We're all kind of wondering what Putin might say in his press conference, but you wrote about this again last month in your latest Amphora report. What do you think the prospect? I mean, let's kind of just talk about why that would be logical, I guess, for them to do that, especially with everything going on in the world. But then what do you think the prospects are of that actually happening? I mean, is it just theory that we're kind of bantering about, or is it actually something that might be put into place?
Well, actually, if you look at the history of Russia and its use of gold, there's a long history to it. And the history goes way, way back. Now, of course, once upon a time, the world, as it were, was on a gold standard back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and Russia itself was on that gold standard. Then, of course, the Bolsheviks come into power, the Russians have their revolution, all hell breaks loose, chaos, civil war, blah, blah, blah. The smoke clears, Lenin emerges triumphant and in control of the country, but oddly enough, Lenin figures out very early on that Russia still needs to be able to trade with other countries, but they're not willing to accept this crazy junk currency that he's introduced to finance his revolution. So guess what Lenin does? Lenin repegs Russia to gold in 1924. So he figures out, whoa, you know, the only way I can get credibility here for my currency, the only way I can trade with other countries is if I go back to some sort of gold backing for the Russian currency. So, I mean, that was a long time ago. Okay, fine. And that was the Soviet era. But then when the Soviet Union was blowing up in 1989, guess what? Gorbachev actually invited a couple hard money economists from the United States to address his inner circle of senior economic policy advisors. And the key suggestion they made was that if you're trying to stabilize and restructure the imploding a Soviet/Russian economy, you should seriously consider using your gold reserves, which were substantial, to back your currency, and that would help to provide a degree of fundamental stability while you restructure your economy. I mean, that's in 1989. Then in 1998, when Yeltsin's in power and Russia is suffering under collapsing global oil prices and also other issues domestically with restructuring its economy, you know, Russia ends up defaulting in 1998. And then again, these same economists who recommended in 89 that Russia consider backing the currency with gold recommend again in 1998 that following the default and restructuring of the debt to reassure international investors that there will be greater stability in Russia in future, they should peg the currency to gold. Every time Russia gets in serious trouble economically, the case is at least being made that Russia should consider mobilizing its gold reserves to stabilize its currency and economy. And therefore, I thought in my recent report, wait a minute, here you've got the sanctions war escalating, here you have the price of oil plummeting, here Russia is intervening left, right, and center to support the ruble, which is in free fall. They've now raised interest rates to 17%. Maybe now we should revisit this old idea. It's not my idea. Revisit this old idea that Russia should take advantage of the fact that it has tremendous gold reserves, as well as just tremendous natural resources generally. This is a country that spans 11 time zones, okay? They have a lot of natural resources. They're pulling gold out of the ground every day. They're the world's third largest producer. There's a lot that Russia could do to restore credibility in the ruble, and one of those things is to use gold in some way, to play the gold card, as I call it.
Right. What would be, do you think, the simplest way for them to do that? I, you know, if you were to make the ruble backed or convertible into gold, I would imagine there'd be some fear there'd be a run on their gold. I mean, would there be a, do you back some government debt with gold? What would be the simplest route for them to actually pull this off and to give that legitimacy back to the ruble?
Yes, that's the what you just said about backing some debt with gold. This is probably the simplest, easiest, most straightforward way for Russia to signal to the international financial markets that it is serious about maintaining a stable currency going forward. And the key is to get interest rates down. They don't want to have interest rates at punishing levels for long because that would cause a deep recession. They'd like to try and establish credibility in some other way to allow interest rates to begin to fall. So this is what I would recommend. rather than just say overnight, we're backing our entire money supply with gold, that would be too disruptive. It would require too many structural changes in the banking system. People would not necessarily think it was credible. And as you say, it could spark simply a quick run on gold, which would be counterproductive. The better thing for Russia to do is to move incrementally and to simply test the water and signal to the financial markets that they mean business by announcing that they are going to issue a government bond, a series of government bond issues, say one per year or one per quarter, which will be redeemable in gold. That is, you'll have to buy them in rubles. They'll pay coupons in rubles, but the principal will be repaid in gold. And say the first issue is maybe a three-year issue to be repaid in gold. And so if you're an international investor, you think, let me get this straight. You know, ruble interest rates are 17%, so I'm going to receive 17% on rubles, but at the end of this maturity of this bond, 3 years, I get to redeem it in gold. So even if the ruble has devalued sharply in the meantime, I get the exact same number of ounces of gold 3 years from now as I would have today. And do you really need a 17% interest rate to know you're going to get your gold in 3 years' time? You probably don't. And so you're willing to accept maybe a 10% interest rate, maybe a 5% interest rate. It has to do with how confident you are that Russia won't simply default on that bond when time comes due to make payment on it. That said, they have the reserve. They have the gold reserves. So it should be a credible action for Russia to take. So here you'll have a bond that's launched, and Russia will be able to claim, hey, look at this. You know, we back our bonds with gold. We can borrow at 5%. And then people think, well, wait a minute, why are we receiving 17% on unbacked bonds? We can receive 5% on this backed bond. Russia comes out with another ruble bond. More people want to buy that one. Well, how do you accumulate rubles? You've got to sell something else to accumulate the rubles. Well, guess what people around the world will sell? International investors overwhelmingly hold dollars as their reserve currency. So instead of receiving 2% on 10-year dollar bonds that aren't backed by anything, you can receive, as it stands now, 17% on ruble bonds backed by gold, or even if the interest rate falls to 5%, you're receiving 5% on bonds backed by gold. It's a no-brainer. It will create a lot of demand for Russian securities. That will help to bring down Russian interest rates generally, and that's probably the easiest way for Russia to proceed in restoring a degree of confidence in the currency and bringing interest rates down.
All right, so that is where almost like a paradox lies, because you and I can see that. Everybody listening to us can see that that's the most logical thing to do. Will they actually do it? Now, I look at the landscape and I see what brought us to this point, and it appears to be the U.S. is doing everything they can to isolate and even provoke Russia, whether, you know, what's happened in Ukraine in the last 12 months, the overt sanctions, as I call it, you know, that they've put on. But I even think that the collapse in oil price was started as a covert sanction. You know, if we know that the Exchange Stabilization Fund, the Plunge Protection Team, can it be in there and help move futures prices to move markets in general, why couldn't they start moving the price of paper crude oil down to the point where the speculators took over, and now here we are at $56. If I'm Putin, I look at that all as, an act of war is too strong of a term, but look what we've done to them and collapsed their economy at the same time. So I would think that, here I am. I'm just this dope out here in the middle of nowhere, but I'd look at that and think, I'm going to do something to fight back. So all of this makes sense, John, I guess is what my point is. What is the actual chance?
Yeah, in theory it does, and you can't rule anything out, and all's fair in war. Now, I don't have any privileged information regarding what is happening behind the scenes, but as you say, we can simply apply logic to some things that are going on and cause and effect and come to maybe some estimation of what exactly is going on here. Now, what I would point out, if you go back to earlier this year and you look at the available data for the exchanges, in particular the Mercantile Exchange, which is where the WTI oil contract trades, mm-hmm. You had a record long speculative positioning earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And that was a warning sign that oil was overbought earlier this year. Okay, so if you go back to the spring, oil was as overbought as it has ever been if you simply looked at the ratio between speculative to non-speculative open interest on the exchange. And that was a warning sign that maybe oil was going to have to come off to some extent. Now, that said, if you look at a chart of that speculative open interest versus the price of oil, what it implied was that oil needed to drop back below $100 a barrel and probably get down to somewhere around 80 or the mid-70s in order to clear that excess speculative positioning in the market. And sure enough, this is what happens. Oil begins to decline. It declines through $80 into the mid-70s, and then it finds support. And when you look at the data released by the exchange, you see that there's been a huge unwinding of these speculative longs to a level which is, you know, pretty much in line with the historical average. And at that point, I got to thinking, okay, you know, we've seen it. Oil prices needed to correct. We've now reached a level that's probably sustainable, and it's unlikely that oil is going to plummet from here. But then, of course, oil does plummet. It plummets into the 50s. And it does kind of make you scratch your head. It makes you think, why is this happening? Is it a supply-driven phenomenon? Is it a demand-driven phenomenon? Or is it simply not fundamental at all? Is it pure speculation going the other way?
Right.
But that seems a bit odd, because if you look at fundamental economic data from around the world, yes, it's been weakening in a lot of places, especially in Asia, to a lesser extent in Europe and the U.S. But does it really justify the massive plummeting in oil prices? No, it probably doesn't. And what's really curious here is the statements you've seen from OPEC members, in particular the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the UAE, odd statements suggesting that they actually were perfectly willing to tolerate oil prices below $60 a barrel. That is unusual.
Yes.
I haven't heard that sort of language in years. And it almost makes you wonder whether there was some agreement made at some point behind the scenes to jawbone, at a minimum, to jawbone the oil price down to levels that would cause economic pain in Russia. You can't rule it out. Again, I don't know this, but I suspect maybe something like this was decided, because I can't recall the last time that OPEC members talked in a way so nonchalant about plummeting oil prices.
If 50% in 6 months, you'd think they'd be a little more upset about it than they appear.
You'd think they would have closed ranks by now and said, we will cut production, we will target an oil price around, who knows, $70, $80 a barrel, something which is profitable for most, if not all, OPEC producers. Because what you're looking at now is not profitable for a lot of OPEC producers. And keep in mind, even Saudi Arabia, you know, their lifting costs, I mean, to use the industry jargon, their lifting costs for oil are perhaps only around $20 a barrel. But the problem is they run a huge budget deficit to fund social programs, which can only be financed if oil prices are above $50 a barrel. And so, I mean, beyond a certain point, even the Saudis are going to find that they can't finance themselves, believe it or not. Even the Saudis have a pain threshold that we got perilously close to in recent days. So it does all seem a bit curious. Certainly from Russia's perspective, they must feel they're under not just sanctions attack, but some sort of OPEC-organized willingness to tolerate lower oil prices. The Russians do feel besieged, that's for sure.
So, excuse me, and I want to kind of go off now in a different direction. I've got one more question for you. And for everybody listening, like I said, I got one more question for John. If there are, again, if you want to, if this prompts some questions in your mind that you'd like to ask John, just use that dialogue box in your GoToWebinar control panel and type it in, and we'll get to those in just a sec. But John, along those lines, the other country that is on everybody's mind when it comes, when we think about gold and gold accumulation is China. There are varying numbers as to what their actual reserves might be. They haven't reported official reserves now in coming up on 6 years. We know it's not 1,000 metric tons, that's for certain. And if any country would seem to have a long-term plan, a plan in place for not just the next 6 months, but the next 60 years, it would be China. And if any country would likely benefit from having some type of reserve currency status, maybe not the world's reserve currency status like the U.S. has enjoyed these last 70 years, but some type of recognition like that, it would seem to be China. Jim Rickards and talks a lot about the IMF meeting that's coming up next fall and whether China will be included in the SDR package and that type of thing. Do you have any thoughts on, I guess, like we just discussed with Russia, do you have any thoughts on whether China might eventually move that direction as well?
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned Chinese reserve accumulation. I mean, China is accumulating reserves faster than Russia is accumulating reserves. The official data is very spotty, but Chinese gold production is the highest in the world. Official Chinese agencies are not allowed to sell gold. Once they accumulate it, they're required simply to hold on to it. So, you know, not only are you the world's number one gold producer, you're not allowed to sell the stuff. Now, private individuals in China, yes, I guess they could sell if they wanted to, but as we know, gold imports into China are running at a very rapid pace, and a lot of that is driven by private demand. So, and you put it all together, and the data, as well as what the Chinese do say when they say it, is strongly suggestive of a strategic Chinese policy of gold accumulation. And then you have to ask yourself, you know, what purpose does that serve? And I think the purpose that it serves, in part, is just basic diversification out of dollars. But I think there's more to it than that. And as you say, the IMF meeting coming up. For years now, there's been this festering dispute at the IMF regarding which country should have which capital allocation at the IMF for the SDR basket. And while this may all be sort of accounting minutiae to some people, actually it's very important when it comes to the U.S.'s ability to maintain the dollar's preeminent reserve status, because a lot of that has to do with the way these capital allocations are determined at the IMF. And the Chinese have been pressing for a larger share. The U.S. has been vetoing that, and the Chinese don't like that. They feel like they're being shut out of what is their rightful role as a more prominent player in international monetary affairs. So these negotiations have been going on for years. China feel like they're getting nowhere. And, of course, as a much larger economy than Russia's, China feels that something should have happened here, whereas the Russians perhaps don't necessarily feel that they would have necessarily made as much progress in this official role. But there you go, right? The Chinese do have a friend in Russia when it comes to challenging the dominance of the U.S. dollar. For that matter, they have a friend in India. They have a friend in Brazil. The BRICS have openly expressed their dissatisfaction with the current set of global monetary arrangements for many years. And those concerns, the rhetoric coming out of the BRIC meetings has only got stronger. So what do I think is going to happen? I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I will tell you this. Historically, major realignments or readjustments to international relations, be it economic, be it political, be it military, it's very rarely just one single country challenging just another single country. It doesn't normally happen that way. And in particular, when you have a great power like the United States in a relative decline, I don't want to suggest the U.S. is going to collapse, but you have the U.S. in relative decline vis-a-vis the faster growing countries in the world, which in recent years have included the BRICS, it's far more likely, I think, that rather than Russia alone challenging the U.S. or China alone challenging the U.S., the BRICS find a way to act together to challenge the U.S. Mm-hmm. It would be less disruptive for each one of them, and it would be more effective in getting the rest of the world, including what I argue to be swing states like Turkey or Germany or possibly even Japan, to reorient themselves more towards the BRIC economies and to support their international monetary preferences, which basically boil down to the following. They're sick and tired of the Fed setting de facto global monetary policy because the dollar is the de facto dominant reserve currency. Right. It's much easier for the BRICS to get through that readjustment in concert, if they can cooperate, then to each try to do so individually, which is going to be a far more disruptive and difficult and dangerous way to proceed.
Especially when the spokesperson of said de facto policy is this kind of mumbling grandmother that nobody really understands. That was quite a farce yesterday, wasn't it? Holy smokes. That was a lot. All right, that's an excellent segue into one question I have in queue. It comes from a listener named Chris. Knowing what you know, I mean, what's your best guess as to how you see the world financial system evolving, say, over the next, I don't know, let's just call it 10 years. I mean, we all kind of accept that the dollar, yeah, all reserve currency systems fail, right? So that's how the history has been in the past. They kind of go their own way, just like the dollar replaced the pound. So, what type of global currency structure do you think is the most likely outcome?
Right. I do lay this out in my book, but I'll give you a very brief synopsis here. I mean, basically, the United States is no longer able to sustain the dollar as the dominant international reserve currency. And the reason why is because the dollar is not credible as a store of value longer term. This is because the U.S. runs chronic trade and budget deficits, is what it comes down to. Now, many people blame the Fed, and I don't not blame the Fed. But the Fed really is simply responding to this domestic need to finance those trade and budget deficits. Because if the Fed chose not to finance them and to allow interest rates to rise naturally rather than to keep them pegged at absurdly low levels, the United States would have to run a budget, would have to not run a budget deficit, might even have to run a budget surplus to improve its finances and reduce its debt servicing costs. And of course, the U.S. would have to become a net exporter rather than to remain a huge net importer. And those are things which would cause a devastating recession in the U.S. And of course, the Fed thinks its mandate is to prevent a devastating recession coming about. So the Fed may claim to be independent, but Milton Friedman and others, I mean, God rest his soul, but I mean, would disagree. Milton Friedman himself believed that when governments ran chronic excessive deficits, that central bank independence would invariably be compromised in the long term. And indeed, we see that happening today. So the dollar is simply not viable longer term. The world doesn't take it seriously as a long-term store of value, notwithstanding its recent strength. And so you do have a situation, though, where a lot of other countries have been accumulating dollar reserves, but at a slower and slower and slower rate. And if you look at the BRICS as a group, they are no longer accumulating dollar reserves. They're accumulating gold, they're accumulating other currencies, they're accumulating real assets of various kinds. And so global dollar accumulation is slowing. And I do believe what's going to happen is it'll reach a tipping point where probably the BRICS, perhaps in concert with a handful of other countries such as Germany and Turkey, will find a way to either through the IMF in an orderly way or through some new set of arrangements in a disorderly way, they will displace the dollar in favor of some new convention for settling international balance of payments. Now, it's my personal opinion that when you move through a transition phase from one monetary regime to another, it's very difficult to come to a detailed agreement regarding how that will be done using unbacked fiat currencies that countries can use in a currency war to just arbitrarily devalue vis-a-vis each other whenever the economic going gets tough. You need a lot of cooperation for that to happen, and I don't think we have enough cooperation in the world today to move from one purely paper regime to another purely paper regime, even if it's balanced in a different way. No, I think the only credible way to manage the transition and the only way that people will trust each other to make good on their obligations to settle trade balances internationally in non-depreciating currency is to settle those imbalances in gold. I do believe we're going to move back to a gold standard to reset the system. That doesn't mean we're going to be exchanging, gold coins left, right, and center, either internationally or domestically. But some sort of link to gold will be explicit, be it just links to gold in a vault somehow for settling international balance of payments. So each country will still have its own national currency, perhaps, but when it comes time to settling the trade deficit on an annual basis or a quarterly basis, the U.S. will actually have to make the gold available to whomever it's been importing from. And naturally, the U.S., of course, is the world's largest net importer, and so the U.S. is going to have to make an awful lot of gold available to the rest of the world as we go through this transition. Now, that's a problem because even though the U.S. has the world's largest gold reserves, the U.S. runs such a large trade deficit that at current prices, the U.S. cannot even cover one full year of imports. That's how big the U.S. trade deficit is, and that's how low the gold price is. If the gold price rises enough, the U.S. could cover its net imports perhaps for many years. But as it stands now, the gold price is too low to allow the global economy to rebalance in this way. Therefore, all these things will happen at the same time. The world will settle trade imbalances in some gold-backed fashion. The gold price will have to rise, and the U.S. trade deficit vis-a-vis the rest of the world will have to shrink. They will all happen at the same time. They're all facets of the same, you know, jewel or gem or whatever.
Right. And you lay that out, and it's logical and orderly and makes all the sense in the world. And I agree with you, and I could certainly see all that happening. I mean, history would suggest that it doesn't happen orderly and logically, though. Yes and no.
Yes, you're right in the sense that there are certainly more examples of international monetary regime change being associated with war and revolution than there are with peaceful versions. But some versions are more peaceful than others, and there are. So don't rule it out. I don't want to rule it out, but you're right. We are entering a dangerous period.
I don't want to rule it out either. That's what we all fear more than anything else, I suppose. That's just something that that's one of those things that keeps you awake at night, hoping it doesn't go that direction. Well, you're being very generous with your time. I just have maybe a couple more questions for you, John, if that's okay.
Sure.
Luke asked about the news today about the Swiss National Bank moving toward a zero interest rate policy. It looks like another implication of this covert sanction regimes crashing the oil price, wrecking the Russian economy. You got a flight of capital out of the ruble into other things, and of course going toward the Swissie. And so they in January apparently are going to institute NERP, right? What do you think of that? Is just all part of an ongoing trend?
Well, just quickly, there's a bit of history here as well. This is not the first time that the Swiss are moving to a negative interest rate. They also did so during previous ERM crises, that is the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, which was the forerunner of EMU. So in previous European crises, the Swiss have also been willing to allow interest rates to go negative to relieve upward pressure on the Swiss franc. So that they've done it before, but yes, they are now doing it again, although curiously, they're waiting until January to do it. And you might think, oh, that's just a year-end thing. Well, it's also the case that the ECB's next meeting is on the exact same day that this new Swiss policy goes into effect. So it could be that the Swiss suspect that the ECB will announce a quantitative easing program mm-hmm. in January, and they want to make sure that their interest rates are negative to help buffer the upward pressure on the Swiss franc that will result from that announcement, because it could be very substantial. Yeah. But you're right to place this in its proper context. This is just another example of a response, a pragmatic response, you could say, to all the excess liquidity sloshing around the world, excess liquidity that's been created by the U.S., that's been created by the ECB, although they haven't created as much, that's been created by the Bank of England, that's been created by the Bank of Japan, and even by China and others. I mean, the fact is, there's this huge liquidity pool sloshing around the world. It does need a safe haven when people aren't willing to take a lot of risk. The Swiss franc is a natural safe haven currency. Here you've got a country with a current account surplus, so it's a net exporter. They've got a reasonably healthy banking system. They have very, very low government debt. They actually have a functioning democracy. They have a democracy which is so powerful it prevents the government running a large debt. Every time the government asks the Swiss people to spend more money, they simply say no. So you have a functioning, sustainable democracy there, which is not clearly the case in so-called democracies that run chronic deficits and which threaten their solvency going forward.
Yeah.
So this is getting a bit cheeky and political, and not everyone on this call may sympathize with this statement, but there are those who believe that Switzerland is the only functioning democracy left in the world.
Yeah, right. And for good reason, I think. Well, to that end, give me one more question from a listener. We had the failed vote to repatriate Switzerland's gold, whatever they have left, back, I guess this is now 3 weeks ago. But there is definitely a movement afoot in Northern Europe, it seems. Germany has it's still attempting to repatriate, over the course of the next 75 years. I think they're getting 1 metric ton a year or something like that. But then we have the news that the Dutch had repatriated a bunch of gold, kind of under the cover of darkness, and now the Austrians are considering it. So Michael's question is, what do you make of these recent repatriation efforts?
I think they're entirely understandable given the state of the world and given the concerns that many people have that gold is being remonetized de facto, if quietly behind the scenes. And the problem is, if it's being remonetized in a world where you can't trust one another, then you've got to have the gold within your own custody. I think that's what's behind this. It may have started with Venezuela, and look, Venezuela is hardly a shining example of anything, but Venezuela had every reason you could imagine to distrust the United States and the United Kingdom, who were the custodians of most of its gold. So you're just seeing an extension of that now to countries as reasonable, as it were, as the Dutch. I mean, come on, this is the country that gave us the word for school. This is the country that believes in education and enlightenment. Many historians believe the middle class, as we know it today, didn't originate in Great Britain. It originated in the Netherlands. Here you've got this eminently reasonable, sensible, tolerant country saying we want our gold back, and Belgium is rumored to be considering the same. The Dutch and the Belgians, by culturally, are very similar. As you say, Austria, there are rumors now. Germany, yes, officially they're trying to get it back, although it's very curious how complicated that's becoming. It's just yet another sign that people don't trust each other. But what's the U.S. really going to do? I mean, how many allies are they going to be willing to lose by saying no, in the event that more and more countries demand their gold back? How isolated does the U.S. want to become as we move into this multipolar world? I hope the United States will be accepting and tolerant of these requests, and will help facilitate them, because it will be a way for the U.S. to transition away from what is simply an unsustainable imbalance of power, as it were, in the global economy.
Well, it's like anything else too. I mean, if you show up at the bank and the bank says, "Well, we'll get you your money in a couple of weeks," you spark a panic. And there are so many of us out here that are at least wise to their ways in so many regards that we look at all the gold that they allegedly store and 9 stories down in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, that type of thing. And we look at it and go, really? Is it really there? We hear the stories, the anecdotal stories about the empty vaults of London. Is it really there? Or at least is it there in sense that it has a clear title? And I mean, if we're allegedly holding serial marked bars, the same bars that they shipped over here decades ago, what is the hassle with shipping them back? And if you don't do it in a timely manner, what exactly are you kind of confirming in a de facto sense? So you would think they'd have an incentive.
It's one of those topics that will simply never go away until a lot more evidence is presented to the public. There are simply too many reasons to suspect that some of the official numbers are suspect, and the unwillingness of authorities to present evidence obviously, causes a number of countries now concern. So, they're going ahead, and actions speak louder than words. Especially the Dutch case, they didn't say a thing about it; they just acted. But we have every reason to be curious. And let me mention something to you also. I like going into the history of these things, and there's a lot of history behind this one as well. Already back in the early 2000s, there was some work done by some quite respective analysts of the gold market, including an old gentleman who's been around a long, long time and has seen everything, by the name of Frank Veneroso. I don't know if you've come across his name before,
No.
but he did some analysis in the early 2000s, and he looked at the official gold numbers for basically every major player in the gold market, including the Bank for International Settlements. And he came up with the result, with the conclusion that the numbers just didn't add up. And he didn't know what the answer was, but the numbers just didn't add up. And he basically said the only way you can make the numbers add up is if you assume there's much more physical gold existing in the world than people claim exists in the world. And he just left that open question. What is the explanation for that? Is it possible there's a lot more physical gold than is in fact accounted for. And so there is this theory called Yamashita's gold, which you may have heard of, which is based on the idea that the Japanese General Yamashita, who was responsible for collecting and protecting Japan's gold hoard in the looted territories it conquered in Asia during the early years of the Second World War, that in fact he accumulated a huge amount of gold that to this day has never been officially documented. And the question then becomes, if Japan wasn't the one holding it after they were, you know, obviously beaten in the Second World War, who did take possession of that huge undocumented Asian hoard of gold? And there's one obvious answer to that, and you know what it is.
Yeah, who won the war? But isn't it almost more likely that it's just the same gold being double, triple, quadruple counted? That there's
absolutely. I'm not saying I have the answer. I'm just saying that a number of answers have been offered to this question that Frank Veneroso asked quite rightly in the early 2000s. So this has been an issue for a long, long time now. With respect to Germany, however, keep in mind, one reason why perhaps Germany is struggling to get its gold back is not because of any true existent physical constraint, but rather diplomatic, just diplomacy. That, you know, Germany did agree many years ago with the U.S. when the Bretton Woods system was breaking down. Germany agreed that it would never demand, and never is a strong word, physical gold back from the United States. That is, it was happy to leave it in permanent custody in New York. And, you know, the Germans are a very legalistic, moralistic people, and when they make a commitment like that, it's very, very difficult for them to, you know, justify changing their mind. And so even if Germany went to the U.S. and said, look, we would like our gold back, the U.S. might say, well, wait a minute, a couple decades ago you signed this agreement saying you would do that. You know, maybe there was some compromise worked out. I don't know. But I think there are historical reasons why it might be more difficult for Germany to get its gold back than for other countries that may never have entered into that sort of agreement with the United States.
And I understand that too. But I sit here and think, well, if it truly is just this barbarous relic that pays no interest and is just collecting dust, what's the big deal? I mean, regardless.
It's so funny you say that, because let's face it. If you look at the people around the world who are the most vociferous critics of gold as money, who are the ones who repeatedly say that gold is just a barbarous relic collecting dust, as you say, these people are the very people sitting on top of the biggest gold vaults in the world.
Right.
How ridiculous is that?
Right. what is it? What should you do? Don't listen to what I say. Watch what I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. If they weren't bothered about it, why didn't they just auction off their gold reserves tomorrow? What's the big deal? Exactly. No, the fact is that the biggest critics of gold as money are the ones who keep it buried in the ground and want it to stay buried in the ground, because that allows them their fiat power, which is arbitrary and which, you know, arguably does not serve the social interest in any fair or sustainable way.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, John, again, thank you. You've been so very, very much generous with your time. I do see there's one more question here I just want to ask, because it kind of feeds in this. Do you think any of these these Northern Europe states, or anybody that's repatriating the gold, are they anticipating an eventual exit of the EU, do you think, or they just simply, just like you said, kind of planning ahead and thinking, why not have it on our shores instead? Because if you don't hold it, you don't own it.
Good question. I think it is only reasonable to believe with high confidence that every Euro area country has an exit plan in place, because everyone knows that while it may be unlikely in their view, it could nevertheless happen. Right. Look, no one knows how orderly that could be. It might be very disorderly. No matter how well planned it is, it might still be disorderly. Other factors equal, you want to have gold at your disposal if that becomes a disorderly divorce, as it were, between the various Eurozone member countries. So it makes all the sense in the world that a country like the Netherlands, which is explicit in having an exit plan, by the way, it makes all the sense in the world that they also have some gold on hand. But I would be very surprised if most other European countries did not also have an exit plan, including, of course, those who would almost certainly have to devalue in the event that they leave the euro area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is existential for those governments. If a country like Spain or Portugal or Greece mm-hmm. or Italy finds EMU breaking up and they have not got a very credible, sensible plan for how to stabilize whatever their money is now going to be, they'll face chaos. They'll face revolution,
yeah.
and they'll fall out of power for sure. So you betcha they've got a plan, and gold may well be part of that plan, especially for the Bank of Italy, which has by far the largest gold reserves, both outright and per capita, of these peripheral euro area countries. Previously, it was Portugal, but they had to pledge that gold, I believe, against their bailout package. So I think the Portuguese have already parted with the bulk of their gold reserves.
Well, like you said, and that may, if this trend continues and it does reach places like Italy, and again, why you certainly be foolish not to if you're Italian. It'd be interesting to see how that continues to affect things, but this isn't probably something that's going away. John, thank you so much for your time. It's been just extraordinarily valuable to listen to you talk and answer questions. We have a tradition around here as we wrap up called the Final Four, just kind of four quick questions. Usually can answer them in a word or a sentence, and it's just a chance people get to know you a little bit better. So if you're ready, can I lay them on you?
For sure.
As I mentioned, you grew up in the U.S. before moving to Germany and then London. You're listed on your bio as a graduate of Occidental College in Los Angeles. What do you recall? What's the mascot there at Occidental College?
It's the Wildcat.
I think that's close. I had it as Tigers.
Is it Tigers? You may be right. Shoot me.
Big
if it is
with teeth and claws and stuff, you're at least in the ballpark.
Oh dear, sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I'm going to mark that down as you didn't get that one right.
Okay. Oh dear.
All right, you're in London. You've got a wife and kids, right? So you want to kind of get them some American food, like a cheeseburger or some fried chicken. Where do you go?
Well, you could go to McDonald's, of course, but there's a very good American style diner restaurant called Joe Allen in Covent Garden.
And they make that kind of fare there.
Oh, you can get a Philly cheesesteak if you want. They've got all the classics.
I like that. I'm writing that down in case next time I find myself over there and I'm missing home. So along those lines, number three, what do you miss, do you think, the most about living in the U.S.?
I miss the great outdoors. Don't get me wrong. There are beautiful parts of this country, but the scale is just different. In the U.S., if you want to get lost, you can get lost. In this country, you can't get lost no matter how hard you try.
I suppose that's true, unless you're in Ireland.
Possibly.
Easier to do there. All right, and finally, kind of a fun question we've asked several folks. You and I are sitting in Joe Allen's cafe having lunch, and I slide an envelope across the table to you that contains 1,200 American dollars. Would you take that money and buy 1 ounce of gold, or would you buy 75 ounces of silver this afternoon?
As the way things stand now, I would buy 75 ounces of silver for sure.
There you go. That's what people want to know. All right. Finally, like I said, you mentioned you write the Amphora report. Comes out. Does it come out once a month? Do you kind of keep it on a schedule, or is it?
No, I try to get one edition out every month at a minimum. Some months I manage a couple. Occasionally I miss a month, but it's pretty much monthly. Yeah.
And people can I'm going to post a link to your latest one, which is just fabulous and a must read, called "As the Sanctions War Heats Up, Will Putin Play His Gold Card?" How do people sign up to receive these in their inbox so they don't have to go searching on the internet for them?
You can just send me an email, which is available on the report. Also, you can go to my website, amphora-alpha.com. That's amphora-alpha.com. And just put your email details into the info box there, and I'll receive that, and I can pull you onto the list from there. Alternatively, just be aware that the M4 report is widely distributed to a range of websites, so wherever you come across it, you can always click on a link, and that link will take you to either my email or another email that can get you signed up for it.
Great stuff. And as I mentioned, the link here to your latest is just a must read. It came out a couple of weeks ago before things really began to heat up. I would imagine you'll probably be writing about this soon again with everything that's been going on. John, thank you so much. This has just really been a pleasure and very insightful. Hopefully we can visit again sometime in 2015 and as the world turns. But at this point, I just want to wish you Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and all the best for next year.
Oh, many thanks. And same to you. Have a lovely holiday. We'll talk next year.
You got it, John. Thank you for coming in. And everybody else, have a great rest of your day.